Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. We'll turn first to the editorial and opinion pages of the Republican American. The date is Wednesday, May the 1st. Yale should reject distraction. With the requisite certification of need approved by the state, we are relieved to know Yale New Haven Health can finally move forward in its effort to purchase Waterbury Hospital from Prospect Medical Holdings. But we are anxious to see the deal get done soon and without any unnecessary interference. Under new leadership, it's almost impossible to imagine Waterbury Hospital's finances and quality of care won't improve. Last month, we argued that Prospect's gratuitous profiteering, declining standards of care, seeming inability to pay hospital staff on time, and derelict responsibility to a patient data hack made the Yale deal an urgent matter. But with the deal not yet reached, the local nonprofit industry is potentially muddying the waters. Last month, the Republican American reported that local organizations are calling for a binding community benefits agreement with Yale. The story noted that such agreements are legally binding contracts between developers, host municipalities, and local community groups that can serve to mitigate local impacts of large infrastructure projects and other types of development, according to Columbia Law School's Community Benefits Agreement database, which logged 55 such agreements nationally. At the forefront of this push is the Naugatuck Valley Project, which describes itself as a network of 23 dues-paying congregations, labor unions, housing cooperatives, and ethnic organizations. Alexander Colacontras, the organization's director, said giving his organization $300,000 over the next 3 years would serve public health. When people don't have jobs, their health is negatively impacted. When people don't have housing, their health is negatively impacted. When environmental issues are not adequately addressed, it impacts people's health. Of course, people can't get good jobs without a good education. They often can't get any job if they live in an area where crime drives business away. They can't afford housing when the housing stock is old. Developers aren't eager to build in the city, and property taxes are sky high. Waterbury has the third highest mill rate in Connecticut, according to data from the State Office of Policy and Management. And property taxes won't decrease until the city pays its debts. These problems require years of steady governance and the kind of economic development a reputable flagship hospital might spur. They certainly won't be, and in fact never have been, solved by nonprofits demanding and dispersing money after taking a cut for salaries and operating expenses. The local nonprofit complex may see Yale New Haven Health as a cash cow, but operating a large urban hospital is a tall task for any organization, even one as large and moneyed as Yale. This is especially true because of Medicare and Medicaid, which increase everyone's costs twice over, once through taxation, and again, when hospitals have to charge the average customer more to make up for the program's insufficient reimbursement rates. Local community groups need to leave health outcomes to the professionals and hold local and state officials accountable for the conditions, such as low literacy and high crime, that cannot be solved by economic redistribution. Opinion. Why Drug Take Back Day Should Be Every Day in Connecticut by Kelly Juleson, May 1st in the Hartford Courant. Last Saturday was National Drug Take Back Day in communities across our state, a day that is marked twice a year as an opportunity to bring in your unwanted and unneeded prescription drugs to your local police department to have them incinerated. Every day should be treated as Drug Take Back Day. Too often, people who misuse prescription drugs get them from their own homes. More than 50% of young people who report misusing prescription drugs obtain them from their own medicine cabinets or from those they know. With the average American filling nearly 20 prescriptions per year, there is a lot of opportunity for accidental or intentional misuse. That makes cleaning out our medicine cabinets a vitally important thing to do. But what if you missed the take-back collections last weekend? Should you throw the medication away in the trash? No, it still presents the threat of misuse. Flush it down the toilet? No, it gets into our ecosystem. Save it for a rainy day? Absolutely not. Some communities have year-round take-back boxes at local police departments or pharmacies. But if you're like me, a well-intentioned, busy mom with three kids, two dogs, a full-time job, and a revolving door of people coming in and out of the house, it may be hard to find the time to package up your unneeded or unwanted medication and drive them to a take-back box. Yet this is exactly the type of household that needs to properly dispose of and deactivate unwanted medications. Connecticut can and should be a national leader in providing easy access, choice, and privacy for safe and proper drug disposal and deactivation. There is a simple option that can provide on-demand prevention any day of the year: at-home drug deactivation and disposal pouches. Over the last 5 months, the Governor's Prevention Partnership has distributed 21,000 Detura drug deactivation and disposal pouches to families in Greater Hartford and New Haven, removing nearly 1 million pills from circulation. U.S. Senators Richard Blumenthal and Chris Murphy included this project in their community project portfolio, providing $1.2 million to fund the distribution of deactivation kits, critical conversation starters, and a public awareness campaign. These pouches take mere seconds to use. Open the top, drop in your unwanted pills, liquids, or patches, add water, shake it up, and then throw it away in the plant-based pouch. The medications are rendered irretrievable for every practical purpose, meaning they no longer present a threat for misuse, and they will not harm the environment when you toss them in the trash. The practical, easy application of the pouches presents a much-needed solution to keep our community safe from drug misuse, and it opens the door for families and friends to talk about it. And because a young person whose parent speaks to them about the dangers of substance abuse is 50% less likely to use them, the partnership has developed key conversation starters for parents and caring adults to make talking to young people in their lives about the dangers of drugs and alcohol just a little bit easier. We need to give our residents more choices and opportunities to dispose of their medication regularly. Every day should be, and can be, Drug Take Back Day. We all have a responsibility to play a role in addressing the opioid epidemic by properly disposing of our medications. So if it turns out you missed Saturday's Drug Take Back Day, you can find resources and opportunities during the upcoming National Prevention Week, May 12th through the 18th. And if you don't have a drug take back box close to you, we have a solution. Contact us at preventionct.org to request up to 5 no-cost Detera drug deactivation pouches that you can use at home any day of the year. Think of it this way. a person is more likely to die from an accidental drug overdose than an automobile accident. And there was once a time not long ago when something as routine as putting on a seatbelt was uncommon. Seatbelts became a simple solution that is easily part of everyone's lives. Now let's make the safe disposal of drugs in the home just as common as putting on a seatbelt. That way, we can make our homes and communities safer and address the even greater preventable tragedy of drug deaths before they happen. Let's work together to make Connecticut a national leader in providing widespread disposal opportunities. Kelly Juleson is co-president of the Governor's Prevention Partnership. More information on drug deactivation can be found at preventionct.org. Editorial by the Hearst Connecticut Media Editorial Board in the New Haven Register, dated April 26th. Can Governor Lamont see the forest for the trees? Former Governor John Rowland is the poster child for this trend that governors and issues about their properties. What is it about that? His career was derailed by a scandal over accepting illegal gifts to renovate his Bantam Lake cabin. Daniel Malloy had to be cleared of accusations that contractors exchanged preferential treatment in return for doing work on his home when he was the mayor of Stamford. It put a pause on his bid to run for governor in 2006. Malloy ultimately won the state's top office 4 years later. During her time in office succeeding Rowland, Jody Rell drew headlines over milder property matters. She chose not to reside in the governor's mansion, opting instead to commute from her Brookfield home. After leaving office, she changed her residency to Florida. So maybe it was just Governor Ned Lamont's turn. Lamont has been an easy target for critics this week in the wake of reports that substantial clear cutting was done in a protected wetland area behind his 2.5-acre Greenwich home. Most homeowners draw attention from neighbors when they remove a tree or two. Town records indicate that 180 trees were cut down behind the Lamont homestead, along with thousands of bushes and plant life. That alone would draw fire from Connecticut residents who rallied against Lamont's environmental goals, notably his effort to fill garages with electric cars. But this gardening work also happened to be illegal, according to the Greenwich Inland Wetlands and Watercourse Agency. Lamont and a neighbor are accused of ordering the culling to create a better view from their homes. The governor is certainly considering the optics in the aftermath of news stories about what one land use attorney in Greenwich dubbed a chainsaw massacre. The news was also sandwiched between Earth Day on Monday and Arbor Day on Friday. Lamont happened to mark Earth Day by helping plant 35 Japanese cherry blossoms at the University of Connecticut football stadium in East Hartford. The governor is popular enough that Democrats and Republicans alike are taking it pretty easy on him. It's better than blowing the issue out of proportion, but it shouldn't just fuel punchlines either. House Minority Leader Vincent Candelora, a Republican from North Branford, struck balance in comments that to see a governor just ignore the laws of Connecticut and do what he wants is not a good look for him. And I think it's something that he is going to have to answer to. Lamont can move on from this by taking accountability where it's appropriate. For the rest of us, it's another reminder of our responsibilities as guardians of our surroundings. We are approaching the peak season of lawn care, which is a much more complicated matter these days, as municipalities consider ways to reduce the use of harmful fertilizers and gas-powered equipment. Now we know that if trees fall in a forest behind the governor's house, it will make some noise. Hopefully some positive lessons will grow from this soil. Dan Haar in the New Haven Register. Connecticut tax collections leap by billions. Here's why we can't spend the windfall. May 1st, from the Hearst, Connecticut Insider columnist. The state's tax revenue forecasters unveiled one of the sunniest outlooks any of us could recall late Tuesday afternoon, that an extra $2.5 billion landing in Connecticut's coffers from now through the middle of 2028, compared with the already upbeat predictions made in January. We might think this news would spark celebrations among people who depend on state programs. After all, we're just 1 week from the deadline for lawmakers to seal the 2024-2025 spending plan. Advocates for various causes, among them Lucy Nolan of End Hunger Connecticut, are sparring over a few $100 million available for added outlays. Surely this new windfall, reflecting Wall Street gains and strong profits from business partnerships, would free up cash for worthy causes. Nolan led a coalition looking for a mere $11.2 million to boost school breakfasts and lunches, money that's far from assured, as House Speaker Matt Ritter, a Democrat from Hartford, hours earlier, called it a nice add-on but not a top priority for his caucus. Best of all, more than half of this latest windfall, $1.3 billion above and beyond what we expected, will arrive over the next 14 months, according to paired reports from the governor's budget office and nonpartisan legislative analysts, known as the Consensus Revenue Forecast. "There's $1 billion, Nolan said to me. 11.2 is how much? Alas, no amount of extra tax collection will help fill the state's unmet needs. Not this year, anyway. The reason, as you know, if you follow the chess game of state budget making, is the so-called guardrails created in 2017 and reinforced in 2023, which limit spending hikes and force the state to sock away most of its surplus money. The overage staggers the mind in a state that not many years ago was reeling. We look through the couch cushions in 2017, and I never want to do that again," said Kathy Austin, a Democrat from Sprague, co-chair of the powerful Appropriations Committee then and now, recalled late Tuesday. More recently, in a $25 billion annual budget, Connecticut has been able to bank $8.5 billion into either the pension funds or the rainy day fund since 2020. Tuesday's forecast calls for another $1.1 billion this year and at least $2.1 billion over the next 2 years, on top of built-in operating surpluses each year, which are part of the guardrail rules. All told, the overage will amount to an average of $1.7 billion a year in excess state revenue over a seven-year stretch, $12 billion in all, if this forecast is correct. Some of that is the result of massive federal pandemic spending, of course, but we're outperforming other states, so some of it comes from the guardrails and other smart moves and from underlying economic strength as Connecticut slowly gains population. Debates about what to do with all this extra money have dominated the conversation over the last couple of years and will now grow more intense as it appears the surpluses, at least part of them, are not just an upward cycle that will soon fall back. Seeing that huge amount of money now, it's almost like in The Wizard of Oz saying, "Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain," Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney, a Democrat from New Haven, said to me late Tuesday. He and other liberals want to adjust the guardrails to allow more spending on what they say are needed state services in education, health, and town aid to control property taxes. Paying down the pension debt, the priority of Governor Ned Lamont, makes sense because that frees up hundreds of millions of dollars a year by reducing the required payments to those funds, which are chronically underfunded. The other obvious answer is give money back to the taxpayers. Pretty much what Republicans want to do. Lamont and lawmakers passed hundreds of millions of dollars in tax reductions over the last 2 years, a modern-day record, but less than the GOP wanted. In short, most state policymakers prefer a mix of solutions. A middle path clearly works best with the guardrails treated like a constitution. Amended sparingly and followed broadly. Key among the guardrails is a rule under which two classes of tax revenues are treated differently. Those are capital gains, dividends, and interest income, mostly from wealthy investors, and income taxes from the profits of business partnerships such as law firms. Those two classes of revenues account for most of the surpluses of recent years and nearly all of the jump on Tuesday. They are considered volatile, and so any amounts over a threshold of about $3.6 billion per year must be saved, not spent. The logic is we'd be in trouble if we built those revenues into the regular spending and then they dried up. Some Democrats say the threshold is too low, since we exceed it year in and year out. Looney, for example, told me on Tuesday that he believes $500 million would be a nice starting point for discussions on freeing up more of that so-called volatile revenue for spending. Lamont, his budget chief, Jeffrey Beckham, and Republican leaders aren't ready for such guardrail-bending talk. They all issued statements hailing the rules, including the cap on spending, volatile revenue, as a linchpin of the state's revival. While other states are cutting services and raising taxes, Connecticut is doing the opposite, which is what happens when we work together on a bipartisan basis to develop policies that benefit all of Connecticut, Lamont said in his written release late Tuesday. This consensus revenue forecast reinforces that we are on the right path and that the progress we have made should not be undone by reversing course. The liberal faction is lighting the fire on the volatility caps to destroy them. House Republican leader Vin Candelora, a Republican from North Branford, quipped, echoing the view of Senate GOP leader Stephen Harding of Brookfield. The excess revenue remains hands-off for this year, with a May 8 deadline looming. But Democrats intend to spend upwards of $400 million in leftover pandemic money, filling gaps caused by inflation and post-pandemic needs. They will boost spending chiefly at UConn and the state college and university system, on K-12 education, on child and youth welfare, especially mental health, and on the nonprofit service providers hired by the state that are perennially underfunded. That's raising howls from Candelora, Harding, and others in the GOP who say it violates the spending rules and will lead to shortfalls next year. This is the last tranche of federal money that the Democrats can have a party with, Candelora said, and I'm just trying to prevent them from having a hangover. Another source of worry, sales tax receipts for the current year are down by a scary 6%, or $320 million, since the forecast released 1 year ago. Some people believe that's more about changing buying habits than economic weakness. I'm not convinced. The largest state revenue source, regular income taxes on workers' salaries and wages, jumped by a little more than 1%, or $100 million for this fiscal year, compared with the estimates made in January. Comparisons to the forecast from 12 months ago are difficult because he states they later enacted a larger income tax cut. The takeaway: Connecticut's fiscal turnaround is clearly riding the coattails of wealthy residents. Whether the rest of us are a big part of the surge remains an open question. Dan Haar is a columnist and senior editor at Hearst Connecticut Media Group, writing about the intersection of business, public policy, and politics. Kathia Karen whines for a glass of water, proving pro-terror students are total weaklings, by the New York Post editorial board, dated May 1st. Imperialist Zionist running dogs, can we please have a glass of water? Sounds like a parody of leftist whining, but amazingly, it isn't. A protester at Columbia University, after her pro-terror cadre broke into and occupied the school's Hamilton Hall on Tuesday, actually, literally said to the press, like, could people please have a glass of water? She added, do you want students to die of dehydration or starvation? The Red Army held out at Leningrad for years, despite facing famine. If the Zoomer leftists of today want the Grim Reaper, the peckish pro-Palestinian had previously pouted that the Hamilton occupiers were asking for Columbia to provide food and water to be brought in. In other words, yes, we'll break into and illegally seize campus buildings, but you better let us get the water. How about a new chant? Globalize the Intifada, avocado and burrata. That this hungry Hamasnik is a weedy grad student whose studies reportedly aim at applying a Marxian lens to romantic literature completes the bleakly hilarious picture. Her demands are of a piece with the whining about amnesty over their illegal actions common among her fellow protesters. A clear sign that these red, black, and green diaper babies are in way over their heads for all their tears, mondiste, tough talk. And it should give hope to the very few adults left in the room that this ugliness can be defeated just by showing a bit of spine, as happened Tuesday at UNC, when the interim chancellor himself hauled down the Palestinian flag hoisted by pro-Hamas thugs and hauled Old Glory back up on the school flagpole as students broke into our national anthem. As for Kathia Karen, there's a very good chance her buddies are getting exactly what they wanted. There's plenty of food and water down at the tomb. Well, that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. I've been reading from the editorial and opinion pages of the New York Post, the Republican American of Waterbury, the Hartford Current, and the New Haven Register. I'm Larry Rifkin. So long. Until next time.